I'm Representative Sherry Springer from SIO, and I want to open up this meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on High School and Transition Success for Students with Disabilities. That's a mouthful. And I'll have you refer to your agenda here. And the first thing we're going to do is entertain motions for the chair. And I will make a motion that Representative Gelser be the chair of this committee. And we don't need a second, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Any other motions on the floor?
I'd like to speak in support of that, unless there's other motions coming.
We will get to that portion, and I'll give you that opportunity. Absolutely. Okay. Do I have a motion to close the nominations?
So moved.
Okay. Any objection to the motion to close nominations? Not hearing any. The motion carries. So we have Representative Gelser as the one nomination for chair. And would you, I am not going to attempt that last name. I don't want to embarrass either one of us, Bob. But do you have something you'd like to say?
I know Representative Gelser has worked very hard on these issues for quite some time, and she's really identified with them. And so I think it's appropriate that she serve in that capacity.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay. Any objection to the motion? Motion carries, and Representative Gelser is our chair, and we'll conduct the rest of the agenda.
Thank you. So the next item on our agenda is the adoption of committee rules, which is in your packet here. These are, Victoria, would you mind describing the rules?
Sure. Please? These are very standard committee rules that we use in all of, actually these are based on the legislature's standard rules and procedures. However, they're adapted a little bit in because we have non-members on the task force. A couple of things that you just need to be aware of is we do not require seconds. So you don't have to second a motion. Another thing you should be aware of is that all of our meetings are subject to public meetings and records law. So this is a public meeting open to the public. We have to post an agenda for the meeting so that the public knows what we're doing, and everything is recorded. So those are, but aside from that, everything is pretty standard.
Are there any questions about the rules? Is there a motion to adopt the rules? Representative Springer?
I would make a motion to adopt the rules for the Task Force on High School and Transition Success for Students with Disabilities as printed.
Representative Springer moves that the rules for the Task Force on High School and Transition Success for Students with Disabilities be adopted. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and we have rules. So we wanted to start off today getting to know the people on the task force. It's a very wide-ranging task force. All of you come from very different backgrounds, different interests, different portions of the disability community, and different sections of our education system and human service system. So we wanted to kick the meeting off with each person giving an introduction, both of yourself and your interest in these issues and the role that you play or the slot that you are representing on the task force. And maybe in your introduction, if you could list what you think are the two greatest challenges for students transitioning beyond high school into post-secondary success that could be at any age along the spectrum, and the thing that you most hope to get out of our work together on the task force. And let's start with Sally.
Hi, I'm Sally. Excuse me, I'm Sally Simich. I was born in Portland, raised in Beaverton school districts, went to Oregon College of Education, and got my master's and my administrative credentials through Lewis and Clark. I've been in education for 35 years. I started before Public Law 94-142 went into effect in Beaverton, and I helped mainstream the first class of students out of Beaverton School District. My position at ODE is an ed specialist. My area of concentration is secondary education, post and I do indicators for the federal government. I do indicator one, which is B1, which is graduation. I do B2, which is dropouts. In special education, my other areas are B13, which is the 8 transition standards for the IEP, and 14 is the post-secondary outcome indicator. I've been in my position for 1 year and 3 months, and I really have enjoyed the things that I've seen and being able to get out and be around Oregon. My, I think maybe the one thing that I see is how we can give some consistency to transition programs so that students moving from one part of the state to the next part of the state have the same considerations. I think some of that, and maybe coming up with some standards for transition programs. And sometimes what I've heard from the field is talking about graduation diploma. Sometimes how we are all interpreting those rules and how it differences between some of the school districts. So I think that might be a concern right now. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Danielle Sheldrake. I am the administrator for student services for the Beaverton School District. So I play the role of the school district director representative on this committee. In terms of my role, I oversee special education, counseling, and ELL services for our district. And so I am highly invested in the work of this task force because we have transition age students in our district, and we have programs and opportunities for them to work towards their post-secondary goals. I would say one of the things, the two challenges we're seeing is the first is just having viable employment connections within our community. In Beaverton, we are better off because we are, you know, a large city with lots of resources. However, we still struggle with community partners who will take our students in to have work experience opportunities. And then in my prior position, I was the director in the Molalla River School District, which is much smaller. So it was even more complex to find work experience opportunities in a small neighborhood community that doesn't have as many stores and businesses. So I think that's one area that's really facing difficulty for transition options. And the other is around diploma and graduation for students with disabilities and the concern with some of the graduation requirements and the concern that students with disabilities may be pigeonholed into a particular diploma option because of some of the requirements and the potential limits for post-secondary options given their diploma options.
I'm Brian Nagaski. I'm a special ed teacher, so I believe that's my role on here. I teach at South Eugene High School. I've been there for 10, 11 years. Prior to that, I worked at Northwest Youth Corps in the alternative high school, so I have a little bit of alternative ed background. I grew up on the East Coast, and I think that plays somewhat of a part on my viewpoint and perspective on things. I think it's relevant in this forum. When I was in elementary school, and I believe into sixth grade, I'm a student with a disability. I had an IEP at that time. I got exited off of that and made it through high school okay. I found that I had some deficits at the college level that hit me pretty hard. Some in the classroom and then other things, but that I think it plays a role in kind of how I work with my students. I'm at an academically rigorous high school that you could use the term like pigeonhole, where we kind of, I believe, are academics driven and the essential skills drive there ends up being all credit and just graduating. And so when I see like the two things that I'm concerned about with students not being successful once they graduate is the lack of continued support with somebody they have a relationship with that they trust, that's willing to help them when they're age 19, 20, 21, 22. Students don't know how to navigate, or people don't know how to navigate that next system without a trusted support person. And in that, I see that just kind of playing a role that they really struggle and stumble in those next steps on where to go. Sometimes the diploma type could help them if they get connected to services. Sometimes it doesn't. A second thing I really struggle with is the funding issue. I really believe is something serious. The public schools are very watered down, and we're down to the bare bones of what we have to do to meet a graduation requirement, and we're not allowed to do outlying services, or we don't have the time in our day to really go to the full extent of what an IEP demands and should be in place there. So like the spirit of law is kind of missed because we're not able to fulfill it.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Randall Minthorn, and I work as a tribal education coordinator with the Umatilla Confederated Tribes. I'm placed at Pendleton High School, where I work in the counseling department for the high school as well as the alternative school in Pendleton. And I would just like to say that I appreciate the Oregon State government declaring this issue as an emergency. Where I work, I also teach the Native American Studies, where we have several of the Native students that attend Pendleton, of which half are IEPs. And so I've been here for 6 years. Prior to that, I served 2 terms on a tribal council. And prior to that, I did 22 years in the Tribal Employment Rights Office. We worked with ODOT quite a bit, the State Forestry, and several other public agencies, the Corps of Engineers, Portland District being one, the U.S. National Forest Service. We did a lot of work in placing tribal members in employment and or subcontracting. We worked a lot with the apprenticeship for the state of Oregon, as well as the respective trade unions. I just want to say that going back to the emergency, last year we graduated 293 seniors on graduation day, of which 14 were homeless. And so I still see that as a real problem, the transition going from high school to anywhere, work or military or into college, they flounder. And a lot of our tribal leaders have begun to request the data on tracking and monitoring our students. And that's a big job. I mean, we don't have a whole lot, but they don't seem to be having a good career path. And for the 5-6 years that I've been here, we ask our students early when they're freshmen about their goals and plans. And a lot of them just aren't ready to make a decision yet, right up till graduation day. So I'm honored to be appointed to this committee, and I look forward to bringing some real concrete answers back to the tribal leadership. That's kind of why they sent me down here to find some help. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Sarah Mendez, and I work at South Salem High School, and I'm their registrar there. I've been there for 7 years and 5 years, almost 6, in my current position. And I'm really excited to be part of this. I see a variety of different students in our school. Obviously, I'm, you know, in charge of graduation. And over the years, I've noticed a trend in new different diploma tracks, you know, modified diploma, extended diploma, certificate of attainment. And when I first started my current position, I noticed that we had just a handful of students on alternative diploma tracks. And as I've been there, I've noticed a huge increase. This year, we have 79 students in our building alone that are on alternative diploma tracks. And I think the biggest issue that our students are facing is communication from staff. I've noticed that our staff, especially our regular ed staff, do not know what the difference is between an extended diploma versus a modified diploma. What are the requirements? Communication's not necessarily going home to parents and to students in an effective manner. I see students having a lot of questions and not understanding what that means for them in their post-secondary career. So I'm really excited to learn some information and see what the state's planning to do and what's going to come out of our meetings. So
My name is Raina Mattson. I am a counselor for Newport High School and Newport Prep Academy. I'm in my 13th year there. I have 800 students on my caseload. And so I am the person at my school that helps walk parents and our special ed staff and just all areas through the diploma options and how to navigate what the outcomes are going to be for their students and how they can try to attain their goals. So I'm here as a counselor. That's my role here. And I am interested to learn more, especially since I'm the one giving that information back at my school. I see a huge need in the financial aid piece, so I'm excited to hear more about that. And then similarly, it's very sad to have students who struggle in one area be forced into a diploma option, and I'm seeing that happen a lot with the new requirements. So I'm just excited to learn more.
I'm Mike Maley. I'm the statewide Employment First coordinator out of the Department of Human Services. And the particular area of focus for that are individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, both children and adults. And it's a systems change endeavor, and I think one of the realizations that we have is that the key to sustainable systems change around improved employment outcomes for that population is the success of high school transition services. I just did want to mention that I am probably one of the lone people here that is a graduate of Crow High School. You don't hear many of them around, a little logging community outside of Eugene. So, but as I was listening to what people have been saying so far, I building on what Randall and Sally have said, I think there's a hard side and a soft side to this. I think the soft side is, in terms of challenges, is creating a culture where parents and children with disabilities and the people that support them see a preferred future of employment and post-secondary education or experiences that lead to employment. And that's a collective experience that people understand, and it's understood early and built on throughout the educational experience of the children. I think the hard side in getting to Sally, I think there are a number of policy and practice issues that need to be aligned. But I think where these two circles overlap is there's got to be continuity of information that's built on from one setting to another that carries from the youth of that individual through their middle school, high school, and whatever their adult situation is going to be. So how do we have a continuity track that's based on that vision and the information we learn and build on?
Hi, I'm Bob Judah. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon in Portland. Disability Rights Oregon is a primarily federally funded protection advocacy office. There's 57 of them around the country. There's one in every state and territory. And so even though we're an independent nonprofit, we're part of that network. And one of the major issues that protection advocacy has worked on since it began in 1977 is special education rights. We are lawyers. I'm a lawyer. I came to Oregon in 1976 as a VISTA volunteer in the Klamath Falls Legal Aid Office and also worked in Coos Bay and McMinnville before ending up back in Portland representing poor folks and children in education matters as well. So over the years, since our beginnings back in 1977, we worked on special ed issues for individual children and their families. And as it's evolved over the years, of course, we know the laws have changed and conditions have changed, but we try to stay as close as possible to the issues that the parents bring to us. As I like to say, nobody calls us because they're happy and they want to praise what's going on. They call us when they have a problem. And just about a couple of years ago now, we convened a group of parents and advocates from around the state just to talk about, well, what are the major concerns in the area of special education? Because people, particularly at that point, seem to be very unhappy about a variety of issues. And the one issue that rose to the top in that discussion was transition services. Just as was said earlier, I think that probably some key points there was the lack of consistency across the state in terms of transition services and the lack of a clear definition of what those services should be, and a feeling by parents that they had the ability to engage on an equal footing as partners with their local school districts and come up with a workable outcome that for their child. And so that's why we're here, just to speak from that perspective.
Hi, my name is Mrs. Marshall, and I'm from Port Oregon, and I'm in college 2013 from Portland Community College, and I graduated Grant High School 2009. I kind of nervous about it, but it's my first time public speaking.
Well, you're doing great. Yeah. I think you have a great future in public speaking.
I'm Bridget Plannery. I'm at the University of Oregon. I'm here as a representative from the University Center on Education and Developmental Disabilities. Though I work cross disabilities, I'm also affiliated with that unit. I'm a faculty member in the College of Education in the special education area, and teach and do research in the area of transition. I should also mention that I'm a member of a statewide task force called Think College Oregon, which is trying to explore post-secondary options for individuals with developmental disabilities. As one of my areas of focus is post-secondary education and the linkage between transition services and preparation for that. So, of course, one of the challenges, I think, is the fact that our limited number of options and supports and the expectation that students with disabilities can go on to post-secondary education, all students, and what does that mean for our state. And I think it's the timing is good. We have a lot of initiatives saying all the we'll move forward, and I'm hoping we'll be able to figure out a way for that to happen. But I also think it's important that I think a challenge is that's seen as a high school issue, and I really believe it's a K-12 issue if we're really going to have students go on to post-secondary education. And we tend to talk about this only to high schools, and it's really late for them to try and make it up. So I also have right now a lot of work going on with freshmen, not with disabilities, just all freshmen, because to be honest, Oregonians, our high school students are all struggling to be ready to go into post-secondary education. So I think my challenges would be that starting early and getting the messages clear to all stakeholders, students and parents and families and helping teachers and administrators. But it's also about, from my other side of teacher training, it's about teaching best practices to students and not having the supports when they get out there as new teachers to implement what they've learned. We can only do so much within our walls or on our campuses. But if they are going to be the change agents, we need some way to not just train and hope that they'll be able to implement them. So it's that continuum also for those who are to be delivering those services. So, and thank you.
Hi, I'm Julie Esparza-Brown, and I'm from Portland State University, and I represent the disability services there. My work really involves the interface of students with disabilities who are English learners and looking at equity, and I agree with my colleague that I really see the issues as a K-12, as a whole systems issue. And I look a lot at, I prepare teachers, I'm in the Department of Special Education at Portland State as well, and look to see, you know, how then we can help our teachers impact the changes and have graduates that are career ready that are more diverse than we are currently graduating and being ready for college secondary education. And I am here to learn a little more as I'm newer to the area, although I've been in public schools for 30 years. So I'm
anxious to learn and see what ways that we can work together to impact positive change on the outcomes for students with disabilities, as well as those who are English learners.
Linda Longpree, I'm a vocational rehabilitation counselor with State of Oregon Voc Rehab. I've been with Voc Rehab for about 12 years now. I always have probably about 10% of my caseload is transitioning students. Voc Rehab has a great program, youth transition program. We were just voted one of the top 10 in the world as far as working with kids with disabilities, so I'm pretty proud of that, although I didn't develop it. The two big issues that I see, there's a lot of them, but two big ones, a lot of the students that I work with, I'm stationed in McMinnville, so a lot of the students that I work with, being in a very rural community, live in poverty or near poverty level, so would qualify for things like the Pell Grant if they wanted to go on to college. Unfortunately, many of them end up getting a modified diploma, which then makes them not eligible for financial aid. So it's kind of this weird catch-22 where those that want to go on to college don't have the resources. If they want to get a GED, that would make them eligible for financial aid, but many of them have learning disabilities, so have a lot of struggle trying to get a GED. So that's kind of what I see as two big issues.
Perfect segue. I'm Susan Deegan. I'm from the Oregon Student Access Commission, and I'm the administrator for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is the state's need-based grant for college students. And at least at this point, we have our administrative rules for the grant used to have to align with rules for federal financial aid, but since we no longer have federal funding as part of the opportunity grant, we don't have to follow those rules anymore. So we are able to make the opportunity grant available to students with modified diplomas. There's nothing in our statute or in our rules that says we cannot. So we assume that means we can. I'm particularly interested in being on this task force because the information that's flying around about financial aid seems to be all over the place. I had a phone call from a high school counselor in Coos Bay last week who had been told that students with modified diplomas could not file the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA, which is not true. They can file the FAFSA. There's nothing that says they can't. The question becomes, how do they answer the high school completion question? And that is something that is probably going to have to be negotiated at the federal level. And I'm glad to see we have someone from Senator Merkley's office that I understand will be talking about that. There's so much information about financial aid out there that students don't know, parents don't know, counselors don't know. So I'm hoping that working with this group, we can kind of get a good set of guidelines and information out there that we can then share with the state at large and with schools and high school counselors at large. My two greatest challenges I see are lack of data. We honestly don't know how many, well, we may know how many students in Oregon complete high school with a modified diploma. How many of those students go on to college? We have no idea. And because the Oregon Opportunity Grant has many more eligible applicants than we can serve in any given year, how do we know how many of those students, how many students with modified diplomas are we already serving? We have no way of knowing this. We have no way of being able to track sort of what their success rate is at the post-secondary level. So just ways of being able to capture data and ways of being able to just make sense of all of this and at the same time figure out how, in a program that has extremely limited funds and at the moment appears to be the only program that students with modified diplomas are eligible for, how do we make sure that those students are served when we have so little money to spread around to begin with?
Good segue, too. I'm Matt Boring. I'm the principal of Corvallis High School, and I've been living a lot of of what you guys have brought up. Also, my other hat is as the father of a 10th grade son, goes to South Salem High School, actually, and he has some real profound learning and behavioral challenges, and so this hits closer to home than the typical high school principal. But I see that really the biggest need, as Susan brings up, I think a lot of people have or think they have little pieces of information about the bigger picture, and so there is a lot of misinformation out there, whether it's about financial aid or about what exact diploma should a kid be on. We had two seniors last year talk about a single challenge in terms of essential skills, one in math, one in writing. A girl got into the art school of her choice in Seattle. There was no way in the world she would ever meet the math essential skill. Blew the writing and reading essential skills out of the water. Will never take a math class again for the rest of her life. And she's glad about that. But she could not qualify for financial aid and hence could not go. Their suggestion was get the GED, which she would pass every area, of course, except for math. And in terms of our language learners, neat kid we have, first language is Farsi, and a lot of years of writing from right to left have made that transition from left to right pretty tough. ACES is math test, ACES is reading test. Now there are some other issues with him getting financial aid, even if he could pass math or pass writing, being from Iran. But still, those types of things. And I think so. If there can be some clarity around what everything means, I can tell you, 25 years working in high school, if I didn't have a son with disabilities, I wouldn't know much, and that is scary for me to admit as a high school principal. But again, it's hard to nail down some of that information, I think. I also would like to see, in terms of transition, I don't think there's been enough planning backwards. You know, what are some templates of programs? I get that they need to be individualized to a large extent, but there are some templates, I think, that could be created provide consistency and viable options, and then a child's education plan should be planned down from that instead of trying to do it the other way around. I think there's too much pressure just to get them out of high school, just to get them through 21 without, you know, really thinking enough of the future, I think. And I really have a vested interest in that one.
And you're close.
I'm Senator Betsy Close, and I represent Lynn in Benton County, Senate District 8. I'm a former public school teacher, taught middle school and high school in both Washington and Oregon. My parents were educators. My father, after he had been a principal, became the director of special education for our school district. And that was in the late 60s when a lot of this began, and I can remember there was a lot of federal money available, and they were setting up programs, but they were pretty much starting from zero. And my father took that on, enjoyed it. We had the Skokomish Indian Reservation was in our county. And so he spent a lot of time on the tribal land, just trying to encourage the families there and, you know, the had disabled children to send them into the schools because they were many at that time. And that was real important to him. He also became the head of maintenance later after that, and he employed a lot of disabled on his work crews for the school. So I grew up with a real feeling of maybe you'd say a burden for the disabled and how we really can, through our government services, you know, improve their lives, improve their future. So I'm really glad to be serving.
Victoria, would you introduce yourself?
Oh, sure. I'm Victoria Cox. I work for Committee Services, and our job here in the Capitol is to basically facilitate these kinds of meetings. So you'll be getting email from me and if you need anything at any time, let me know ahead of time, and that's what I do.
And Patsy?
I'm the administrative supervisor for committee services, and when my staff gets spread thin, I get to take meetings too.
Representative Springer.
Excuse me. I'm Sherry Springer, state representative from House District 17. I represent 11 little communities in Marion and Linn counties. Go up past Detroit to the Brighton Bush area and up past Sweet Home in Cascadia, have Sile, which I'm from, and have a junior in high school and work on a lot of education issues.
And Holly is here from Senator Edwards' office. Would you kind of speak for Senator Edwards, make his introduction?
So Senator Edwards is Senate District 7, Eugene, Junction City, and he's super excited about this task force, but unfortunately on his way to the Capitol today, his car broke down, so he wasn't able to come. So we just asked that I come and share with you guys that he serves on the Oregon Autism Commission, and he was a little bit concerned that there isn't any representation on this task force from that commission, and just wanted the rest of you task force members to know that he really hopes that ideas from the Autism Commission, they also had a high school transition subcommittee, so ideas from them and thoughts would be included and thought of as you guys are doing your important work.
And I spoke with Senator Edwards this morning, and in response to that, at your places is the list of recommendations from that subcommittee on the Autism Commission. So we can see those and certainly access that as a resource. And then I wondered if we could just briefly have introductions of the other people that are visiting to observe today. You can say who you are and why you're here.
Good morning. I'm Arlene Marshall. I'm Lindsay Marshall's mother. I'm also a special ed teacher. I graduated from Lewis and Clark College, went back to Portland State with a master's in education. I was a part of a dual secondary program that they have at Portland State, and this is to focus on engrafting special ed students into the regular classroom without having a stigma, and that's what I do. I'm subbing now.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Paul Marshall. I am Lindsay's younger brother, a recent graduate of Morehouse College. Basically, I'm here to support Lindsay, but, you know, I've been with Lindsay, kind of worked with her for a while now, and she's a good friend, and obviously she's my sister, but we've talked about a couple of things, and a lot of what's been said so far, we've had a conversation, and they've been echoed, and one of the things that Lindsay kind of harps on sometimes is you know, once she finishes her program, what's kind of the next step for her. So I'm sure as Lindsay will continue to flourish. Great job public speaking, by the way. Very good job. But about what's the next step for her. So looking forward to hear what's going on. Excited to be here.
Soren Metzger with the Oregon School Employees Association. We actually represent educational assistants and bus drivers. Our members work with students with disabilities, so it's really important for us to hear what's going on. So,
thank you. I am Chris Garrow, and I work for Representative Gary
Oxford. I'm Oregon Allen. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association.
Derek Brown, Director of Assessment at the Oregon Department of Education.
I'm Chad McComb. I'm the Legislative Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Education.
I'm Kathleen Ryan Jackson, and I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Positive Behavioral Interventions and Support.
I'm Ozzy Rose, and I've just been around a long time. I've represented people in the education interests here in the building since 1974, and I'm interested in kids, all kids, kids, all kids.
And my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis, and I chair the education committee in the House. I became interested in this issue when my son was born. I have a son who will be 19 in a couple of weeks that experiences intellectual disabilities, and he attends Mr. Boring's school, and I believe checks in with Mr. Boring every day.
And checks out every day.
So Mr. Boring's a very patient person. I'm very excited about this work group and have had the opportunity to meet many of you around the table working on different pieces. And one of the common
themes that has come up over the last couple of years is that we didn't have a forum where everybody could come together to talk. As we looked at the implementation of the modified and extended diplomas and the overlay of the new regular high school diploma requirements, it became clear that from district to district and sometimes even from high school to high school within a district, there were very different understandings. If you then transport that to the understanding of community colleges and universities and employers, what do these documents mean? It became even more complicated. Some of the other things that we noticed, one of the reasons we really wanted to have a registrar on the task force, it was Mr. Boring that pointed out that the way that we transcript student credits towards a modified diploma can actually impact whether that student can transition to a regular diploma later on and help them understand how close they are to meeting that goal. And that there really isn't consistency understanding what's a modified credit and what's an accommodation and how should we be recording those things on transcripts so that employers and community colleges and universities can work on those things and financial aid officers. Obviously, also the financial aid issue is one that weighs heavily on so many people. We don't want the doors for kids to be shut to every program when they leave high school. And unfortunately, the change in federal law that happened 2 years ago doesn't even just impact four-year colleges, but also two-year degrees and any career certificate. So a student that leaves with a modified diploma that wants to go and get a culinary arts certificate or a welding certificate, unless they can private pay for that, they are unable to do that. This legislature in the last session tried to take up some of those issues, which is why we have this task force. We also passed House Bill 2898 that was supposed to address in a small way that financial aid issue. It actually requires the Oregon Student Assistant Commission to provide Oregon Opportunity Grants to students with modified diplomas that are accepted to Oregon institutions, and that's now in statute. And it also changes the definition of transition services to include enrolling at a college or university for credit. So a student that has a modified diploma in their 18 to 21-year-old transition program under this new law can enroll at a community college and earn those credits for that welding certificate or that child care certificate or the two-year degree. And then when they leave at age 21, they may still have a modified diploma rather than a standard diploma, but they have that professional degree or certificate and actually fall within the 40 of our 40-40-20 goals. And our thought was that that was a better use of those resources for kids that were appropriate for state school fund dollars for those students between 18 and 21. So we'll have to see how that all plays out. So my hopes for the task force are that we start a discussion, we get a better statewide understanding of what all of these things mean, and that we also do push back into the earlier grades of K-12. I think on the employment side, as we're looking at this Employment First Task Force, it's true. If we want kids to participate in competitive employment at or above the minimum wage when they become adults, they have to have a quality education. We know that that's true generally for students. It's absolutely true for students with disabilities as well. And if we can take a fourth grader or a fifth grader or a seventh grader and be designing their day with our eye on that goal of this kid is going to graduate with a diploma that has standards and a plan to move on, that is going to inform how we plan for that student every year, just as it does for students that don't have disabilities. And unfortunately, for many of our students with disabilities, they really are kind of saddled with this burden of low expectations. And so the focus does become, how do we get them through this year? How do we keep them out of trouble? How do we pass them on to the next grade? Rather than, how do we really support these kids with specialized instruction to be as successful as they can be so that they can enroll in college like Lindsay, or get a welding certificate, or go and study art. So that is me. So we wanted to do an overview of House Bill 2743, what our task is, and the bill is right in your pile there.
Representative Gelser?
Yes.
Is it all right if I move one over?
Yes.
So that Lindsay's not out in the corner by herself?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Please do. And people should feel free to move as you wish. There are restrooms down the hall. Is the men's room down the hall as well?
All the way
is
out.
It around. Is it around the corner? Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
The other end of the building.
I know we have them around here somewhere. So House Bill 2743 gives us two kinds of tasks. The first is to study a whole variety of issues, which really means that we are going to talk about them here, and that each of us coming from different places with different sets of expertise are going to be able to bring the information together so that we can compile that for the legislature. The second task that we have is to develop recommendations for legislation, for future legislatures to adopt if it is necessary to change any laws related to transition success for students. It may be that we find that the laws say what the laws need to say, and we need to look at administrative rule, or we need to look at training or communication. That's part of what we'll study and find out. So if we get to the end of this process and we don't see a statutory change that needs to be made, that isn't a failure of the group. I think it's always important to know that we don't want to get to the end and recommend laws just for the sake of having a bill and saying we did that. Sometimes we create more trouble in that way. But as we're going along, as we're having these conversations, and certainly if you have ideas even as we start, let's start collecting those. If anything that you share with Victoria, she can share back out to the rest of the group and can keep those ideas as we're moving along. Between meetings, if you have information and ideas, if you send that to Victoria and I, that way we can come up with those at future dates. So you'll see that as you've heard from each other, our membership is quite diverse, and the topics that we have been asked to study really cover pretty much all of the areas that you raised. Everything from better understanding what these different diplomas mean to what are the barriers, how many kids are there. One of the things that didn't get mentioned going around the table that is in here is how to better use technology as an accommodation and a support for students both in their K-12 experience and transitioning onto high school, the issue of documenting the support services that a student needs. When they enroll in a college or university, they need to have that documentation with them so that they're eligible for the student services and supports that they need. Without that, they may not be able to get it. And we do have a couple of folks that are disability service officers that weren't able to be here today as well, and they will bring some information to us. And then the other is how we can ensure that programs in our high schools, right now we have a lot of focus on helping kids in high school earn college credits. So whether that is a university credit, an AP credit, in our school district we have College Now programs where you get a credit through the community college. Looking at our students with disabilities accessing those, and are we actually reaching out to those students to let them know that this is available to them? It becomes doubly important to them because of the financial aid situation. It helps them have those credits that can help them move on. And also, how are we talking to these students about post-secondary and college? I had a town hall the other night, and one of the questions come in on cards, and one of them was, what would it look like if we had a college night for kids on IEPs and 504s and those that have B and C averages instead of just those that have A's, to talk about the whole variety of post-secondary opportunities that are there and really proactively reach out to that population of students. So that is along that theme. And then the legislation is supposed to address those same issues. We have two key dates in here that are important to the group, and it's a very aggressive timeline, so we'll have to work and communicate relatively quickly. Our first report to the legislature is due in February, this coming February, and our final recommendations are due in July. The reason for those dates is so that if we report back in February, it makes sure that we got off the ball and started meeting so we can tell that we've met. But we really, because of drafting deadlines, need to have a sense of where we're going if we're going to have legislation for the 2015 session as we're moving into the fall so that we can start working on the drafting. Are there questions about our tasks or additions people would like to make? As you've read the legislation, is there anything that you see that seems to be missing that we should be adding to our work plan? Mike?
Well, I was thinking more in terms of membership, and perhaps it's on here and I'm not seeing it, but I think the association with the workforce development side of things, you know, the local workforce investment boards, that whole mechanism, I think would be a helpful membership, or somehow bring that information to the table, certainly as it relates to apprenticeship, paid job, you know, opportunities, right. Those kinds of things. So I would just put that out for consideration.
And that's an important point, both because those are important people to bring to the table, but also this membership list are the voting members of the group. We tried to figure out how do we get everybody at the table and not have a group of an unmanageable size. And the discussion was we can bring other people in to the conversation as needed. So whether that's the Autism Commission or workforce development folks from the local level.
Yeah, and my thought was there are so many complementary players outside of this circle that need to are keys to success also, so keeping an eye out for those.
Any others? All right. Where did the computer go?
He set it up for you.
Oh, great. So we have a couple of presentations, one from ODE, and this one is... It's an old presentation that was given to the Oregon School Boards Association last year about the Oregon Modified and Extended Diplomas. There's a lot of confusion about what they are and where they came from. We have some articles that will be on the back in a couple of minutes. They're in that big stack next to Representative Springer. The Oregonian did some writing on this when we first instituted the Modified and Extended Diplomas. And we also have a sheet that talks about the graduation rates for students in different districts across the state, so you can see that. Where that goes. And this isn't a PDF because Keynote from Mac doesn't really translate to PowerPoint. You have seen it. All right. Okay, so one of the reasons that we want to talk about this population is that we talk a lot about the achievement gap. We talk about English language learners, we talk about students of color, which poverty, language, race, but usually when we talk about the achievement or the opportunity gap, we forget to talk about students with disabilities. And this group, if you look at the data, is the minority group that has the lowest graduation rate among all of the subgroups and the highest unemployment rate when they leave. So addressing the needs of these kids is critically important. Our graduation rates for them are very low. Statewide, it's a 42% graduation rate in 4 years, 47% in 5 years. We just pulled some of the bigger districts out there. Tiger Tualatin, 47.5, and then 64.6 in the fifth year. Lake Oswego at 46 and 66. Portland Public, 29% after 4 years, and 31% after 5 years. And Clark County, Washington, by comparison, graduates 68% of its students with a regular diploma in 4 years. And I found that to be really interesting because that Clark County, Washington, if you think about Vancouver, right over the bridge from Portland Public Schools, the economy is similar, the population is similar. What is the difference? I don't think it's the capacity of the students to learn and achieve. Representative Springer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What are the dates of this data?
This data is combined from the information that was submitted to the federal government and the achievement compacts for the 2010-2011 school year.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Do you have information on what the diploma requirements are for Washington?
We've been trying to get that. They do theirs in a different way that may or may not be a good idea. So if you are on an IEP, you can be granted a regular diploma even if you haven't met all of the standards that are outlined for their standard diploma. And we're trying to get more information about exactly how that works. Washington is one of only, there are less than 10, so Oregon is not alone. Nationwide, there are less than 10 states that have more than 50% of their students with disabilities graduating from high school across the country.
Representative Gelser,
yes.
From what I understand is that they have one diploma type, but as part of their transcript at the bottom it says met essential skills, met essential goals. So students on IEPs get the goal piece. Any registrar that would Google that from wherever gives you the information of what that means for that student with the regular diploma.
And do they still have to take the same credits as the other students?
Things are modified, things are different, but same amount of credits. I mean, yes, same amount of credits, but things are modified. But they're working off of their individual goals rather than the essential skills tests that they pass.
Excellent. Representative, yeah, one more question. In that data, does it include students who graduated with modified diplomas, or is it just the standard diplomas?
This is just the standard diploma. And so this does not include, in that fifth year rate, that is a standard diploma after the fifth year. That doesn't include the modified diplomas after the fifth year. But the year of this data, it was before the, so we passed the modified diploma law in 2007. So last year's kids were the first kids where 100% of the kids that got a modified diploma met the standard. So it would have been difficult to know what those modified diplomas meant for that fifth year. Does that make sense? So we also know that students with disabilities are a significant portion of district population. Statewide, it's 13.2% of our population, and ranging from about 10 to 14%. Of course, school districts are capped at 11% in terms of their second weight reimbursement for special ed students, but we know most districts have more than 11% of students within their districts. And the reason this slide is important is if we're having this conversation about 40-40-20 and all kids graduating from high school, and you go back to that first piece where we don't talk about these kids more generally when we talk about the achievement gap, we can't reach those goals unless we specifically look back at this population of students and figure out how to get them across the finish line. And all of the kids that are in the slideshow are kids that are either on an IEP or a 504 plan someplace. And you all know this, but in kind of in the audience that this was created for, I think there's a lot of assumptions about what a special education student looks like. Special education students look like all kinds of things. Who are these students? Which leads into that. She is cute. She's my daughter. If you look at the population of students that goes into that, a lot of people think about very stereotypically difficult high-intensity disabilities when they think of kids that are on IEPs. But as you can see, the biggest chunk of kids, the biggest single chunk of kids are kids with a specific learning disability, kids that have a specific challenge in reading or in math. And if you go back to this idea of the essential skills, that's where we're going to see this increasing barrier for these kids to get a standard high school diploma. You also have a good chunk of kids, 6% with mental health issues, 14% that are other health impaired. We went to look at how different districts were defining this. In Portland, they did an audit of their, Portland Public Schools did an audit of their disability categories to see what was in it. For that district, the vast majority of other health impaired was ADHD, mm-hmm. So a behavioral basis, 25% communication, and this is all kids, so this is also including those kids that receive special education services when they're younger and they transition out of special ed services, autism 10%, intellectual disability making up only 5%, and the low incident disabilities, which are some of those high intensity disabilities, only 3%. So, you know, for me, kind of looking at that data, I think most people would be surprised to think about who those kids are and then think about that graduation rate on the other end. Yeah.
Can you flip back to that?
Yeah.
Is that state percentages?
Yes.
Okay. Is that a cross-section of multiple grade levels, or is that a cross-section of, like, one grade level that would then look into, like, how their initial eligibility got made with the teasing out of, like, how when you're working with a primary, like, elementary school student who is displaying other health impairments, but they don't have the documentation, so they categorize them under specific learning disability, although as they progress, like, their disability takes them in a different direction. Of like, has that kind of been brought up?
That's a really good point. It would be interesting to be able to get in the data that way. This is a snapshot. So this is from the eligibility information that was submitted in a specific year, okay. In that 10-11 school year.
And then all
K-12. Not early childhood isn't here. So early intervention, early childhood special ed is not included. It's kindergarten through 12th grade. So modified diplomas, there's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding, I think, about what a modified diploma is and isn't. The first thing is that it's not a special education diploma. A student can receive a modified diploma even if they aren't in special education, if they have a history of an inability, and this is straight from the statute, history of an inability to meet grade level expectations despite appropriate accommodations. And the second piece is that the eligibility for that modified diploma has to be determined no later than 2 years before the anticipated high school exit. These criteria are important for two reasons. One, when we passed this legislation in 2007, it was at the same time that the standards were increasing for the standard diploma. And there was some concern that if we created a modified diploma, that districts would just kind of slap more districts would just slap a modified diploma on a credit deficient student, that you wanted to make sure that it was not a lack of instruction, or it wasn't a lack of coming to school, or any of those other things. It really was this history of the inability to meet grade level expectations, because the intention was every kid that can earn a standard diploma, we should be doing everything that we can to get them to that standard diploma. And that's why the eligibility has to be determined no later than 2 years before the anticipated high school exit. That means it's not a credit deficiency, but we've identified that the student is eligible. That's the other thing that's key in this. It's just a definition of eligibility. A lot of people talk about a modified diploma track. It isn't a modified diploma track, because the statute goes on to say a student must be allowed to, even if they are eligible for a modified diploma, to continue pursuing a standard diploma all the way until they turn age 21. So it's not because you have made this eligibility in the 10th grade or the 7th grade that it has to be a modified diploma. It's just that documentation that it's not because of a credit deficiency. Oops. Where did this go? And the other piece that goes with that that's not in the slideshow is that, in addition, and this was added later, in the year that the student earns the modified diploma, the parent and the student have to be provided with written documentation explaining that it's a modified diploma, and they have to sign consent that it's a modified diploma, recognizing that it's not a standard diploma. So that's that check again, where they are then again told you still have the right to continue pursuing a standard diploma even if you've been awarded this modified diploma. So the modified diploma put into statute specific credits that a student needed to earn in order to get the modified diploma. The reason this was important is that prior to the law, different districts determined for themselves, A, whether to have a modified diploma, and B, what that modified diploma was. So some districts, the criteria was, if the student gets at least a 50% in a class, they can get a modified credit, and if they have enough credits, they get a modified diploma. In other districts, there wasn't necessarily a standard, and if a mom called up and said, I really want my kid to walk and get a modified diploma, they would print out a modified diploma and give them a modified diploma. So that meant that when that kid left, it really was a piece of paper that there was no, you didn't know what it meant. So we created these credits that aligned with the standard diploma, because again, the idea was to keep the students engaged in classes, engaged in school, so that they could stretch for that standard diploma later on. So you're keeping them as often as possible in these regular classes. So 3 credits of English language arts, 2 of math, 2 of science, 2 of social science, 1 career technical ed, 1 in health, 1 in PE, and then a lot of flexibility in electives in that 12. It can be pretty much anything to meet the unique needs of that student. So it could include additional core, career tech ed, career development, or it could be traditional electives, or it could be additional classes. Maybe the student really likes literature, so they want to take extra literature classes. The extended diploma is different. That student must be in special education. It's a special ed diploma. The students, and this is actually no longer true because we changed the law. The modified assessments went away, so did this requirement. It didn't make sense to require something that didn't exist any longer. And at least 6 classes have to be outside of a self-contained classroom. This diploma was really designed more for students that experience intellectual and developmental disabilities, and the impact of it has been more students having the ability to access history and science and social study classes that they are interested in taking, because every high school must allow them to enroll in those classes. The extended diploma credits in those 12, it's 2 English language arts, 2 math, 2 science, 3 social science, an art or foreign language, a health, and a PE credit. And again, they could earn more than 12 credits. So you don't exit the student from high school just because they've earned 12 credits. We came back and changed that in the law, too, because some districts were doing that. The student can still stay for all of those years, but they have to get credits in these areas in order to get that extended diploma. The alternative certificate is the third area. There are no requirements for the alternative certificate. There are no standards for the alternative certificate. It basically is a certificate of attendance. The student came, they participated, and that is why it does not count towards the five-year completion rate, and it does not on the achievement compacts, and it doesn't count towards the state's 40-40-20 goals. Those students would fall outside, which by definition would mean we don't want kids getting alternative certificates. We want to be supporting them into one of these other three diploma tracks. And these students also in the financial aid bill that I mentioned that we passed before are not eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant through the alternative certificate. To access Oregon-based financial aid, they need to get an extended or a modified diploma or a regular diploma. And then districts are required to provide the needed resources for a student to earn a standard, modified, or extended diploma. No school district can opt out, and it has to be available at every high school in the district. The parent or the student, if the student is the age of majority, has to give consent to get the non-standard diploma. The modified and extendeds both count towards the five-year completion rates and the 40-40-20 goals. And then parents and students have to be informed beginning in the fifth grade of all of the diploma options. And that really goes back to what a couple of people were talking about. If you know, as the student is transitioning to middle school, that in order to get something that counts towards the 40-40-20 goal or is counted as a graduation requirement, that you have to take academic classes and you have to be outside of a self-contained classroom for at least 6 credits, that's going to change the way you build your middle school plan. So it really starts to hit those changes. We see a lot of kids that maybe had some inclusion in elementary school start to lose that as they get to middle school. And if a student isn't taking general ed classes or having some access to that content, it's going to be really hard for them to do that in high school. And then it also requires that students be allowed to walk with their graduating class or roll or however they would get across the stage. In 2007, when we passed the legislation, there were some districts that did not allow students with disabilities to participate in their commencement exercises, which was really sad. So the whole idea behind the modified and extended diplomas was to create kind of this idea of high expectations. We want every kid to get to where they want to go. The unintended consequence has been this idea that it's a track, and if you're eligible, that's what you should get. And the bottom line is that for any student, we want every student to get a standard diploma, if they can possibly get a standard diploma. If the choice is between a standard diploma and a modified diploma, it should be a standard diploma, even if that student will have a lower GPA, even if it will take that student a fifth year to do it, because they're going to have access to many, many, many more options in their future, military, financial aid, all kinds of other things. But if it's a choice between a modified diploma and nothing, these modified and extended diplomas demonstrate high expectations. So that student that doesn't have a standard diploma can go and show a university or an employer, I've set goals, I've been held to standards, and I have met them. I think this is going to become more important as we implement the essential skills. And I think what we'll see, especially because the modified diploma isn't a special education diploma, we are going to see more kids who are like what Mr. Boren described around the student that went to art school. They may be excellent students in every area except for math. And I think the way you described it the other day, they're at a 232 on their OAKS, and there just isn't anywhere in their brain that extra couple of points that they need. It doesn't matter what you do, they aren't going to get there. And so they may have AP English and literature, AP English and social studies, but they're not going to be able to get financial aid for college and may not be able to enroll. So those are some of the problems that we need to address. Are there any questions about how the diplomas work or what they are, what the requirements are between each of them?
I have a question. Was there an intention of who would notify options starting in fifth grade? Like when whoever was making that requirement, district can mean a lot of different things.
So for a student on an IEP, it tends to be passed out at the IEP meeting, but it is also supposed to be in district handbooks
as well.
So that's sufficient.
That's sufficient. And I think our middle schools in our district now, I believe that I've seen it in the packet, in that transition packet for all kids as you're going to sixth grade. And again, we wanted people to know that, yes, even if you have a student with a significant disability, they can enroll in classes, in academic classes, in a regular classroom.
Do you know if that the packet that you're talking about is translated also?
I have seen it translated in our district. I would imagine districts are translating. Do people know from?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One thing I've found, especially the last couple of years, is in some ways the discussion around the modified diploma is hurting us, in the sense that the IEP team minus the parent, and so the teachers and the staff, we feel like you can get a regular diploma. And some of the early discussion of the modified, the family shut the door. Nah, he's never going to pass math. We just want a modified diploma. And we're saying, no, you can make it. But so that piece of it has been hard, because we get some kids walking through the door deciding that, or the, it's not really the kid, it's more the family. We're done with math. We're not even going to try. And so I don't know why I'm seeing more of that. Not necessarily seeing more modified diplomas, certainly not less. But so that piece of it, I mean, I understand the reason behind starting the discussion early, but it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for some kids who could make it.
Representative Gelser, was that put into place the early? I know earlier is really important, so I wouldn't say, but that specific discussion at an IEP meeting, was that put into place because we were talking about an alternative assessment track, and that they need to be in those two cycles prior to high school if they're going to work for like the extended diploma? And I think so some of the comments that I've had around the state is that they told me in fifth grade they couldn't take regular tests. They aren't going to get a regular. I mean, but that really wasn't the conversation. What the conversation was, if your student stays in an alternative assessment track, they can get an extended diploma as a part of their program. You're giving them that information. You're not telling them that's exactly what you're doing. But I think some of the schools put kids in that track because they knew they had to be in those two assessment cycles before they got to high school where they were tested. Now that that's been removed as a requirement, we might see something a little different, I think. So and the conversation
I,
was.
And I had that wasn't the conversation about notifying at fifth grade.
Uh-huh.
That the point of that conversation was to keep kids in academic classes.
Okay.
And not have them. And when we first started the conversation, it was more about students with intellectual and developmental disabilities kind of going off onto this vocational ed track at the sixth grade, where they were cleaning cafeteria tables and shredding paper and not really doing reading instruction anymore. But I can see how that would.
So that's what I've heard from some people, is what they thought when that started.
I was thinking, Matt, to your what you said, what I've seen happen, though, is the families who come in and are wanting the modified diploma, even if we're going to go through 10th grade and we're going to work our butts off to get you a standard diploma, is the options for the student when they graduate aren't there. And so, well, there's 21 years, you know, up to 21, that gives 3 more years that we can work on skills. So sometimes that has been one of the things that has happened, which is kind of why, you know, what are the options for students when they graduate? That has been kind of the push there for some of those students, I think.
I think the other thing that I think we need to think about is, as you said, it can be written in the handbook or it can be passed out, and we're asking fifth grade teachers, and it gets back to that earlier, that have no clue about the impact or how high schools work or what's most important. And so I think that pushback, I think early is important, because it's not about making a decision as much as it is about understanding I have options and why it's important not to be unmodified. But if we aren't presenting it that way and teaching the teachers to present it as you need to work harder between 5th and 8th grade to make sure they've got the accommodations and skillful use of those to be able to use them in high school so they don't need modification. But that's not the way it was translated and how they're seeing it. So I think it's a communication issue of understanding the importance of 5th grade is not to make the decision, but for you to think differently about how you use those last 3 years.
Are there other things on this topic before moving on to the next one? Great. So next we have the Oregon Department of Education is going to give us some transition outcomes information.
Is it okay if I stay here? And because there's a couple slides in there that I was going to speak to also with Derek.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'll just drive for you when we get
okay.
There, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right. Okay. Thanks very much for the invitation to come over today and talk a little bit about graduation outcomes for students with disabilities. I've designed a fairly short slide deck that's going to talk about some of the graduation rates, maybe in a little bit more detail, and compare to some other subgroups. I think that will mostly just help contextualize your conversation as you move forward. Also talk a little bit more about the dropout rates, and then Sally has some slides that she'll speak to as well. And again, my name is Derek Brown. I'm the Director of Assessment at ODE. And for those of you that I've interacted with in the past, really for the last 4 years or so, my job recently changed a couple months ago. I've been the manager that's overseeing the essential skills graduation requirements, and really mostly the assessment component of that. So what I'm going to just really quickly talk to, Representative Gelser sort of covered this already, so I'll go quickly through it. Overview of the different options. I've displayed it a little bit differently than her previous document. Talk about some trends in graduation rates. We'll take a look at specifically students with disabilities and what their trends and counts look like with regular, modified, and extended diplomas. And then we'll go into a little bit more detail about the essential skills requirements and how students meet those requirements. We'll talk about the differences in approved assessment options, if you will, and then dropout rates, and then I'll hand it over to Sally for a couple things as well. So this is just a table version of what Representative Gelser just showed you. You can see that for the regular and modified diploma, there are 24 credits required, and there are essential skills required. And then there's some additional information there about documented history of inability to meet academic standards and so on and so forth. And then, again, the extended diploma it has some other differences to it. My work, really, over the last 4 years has really focused mostly on the regular and modified diplomas because the essential skills are applied to those two outcomes. We do not apply the essential skills requirements to the extended diploma or other outcomes. So this is, we're going to kind of start big and work down a little bit, but these are the 4 and 5 year cohort graduation rates for all students going back to the 2008-2009 class of year, if you will. And I want to clarify a little language here just so that everybody understands what we mean by some of this. When we say cohort graduation rate or cohort graduation, that's a reference to a regular diploma. And the requirements are applied, both credits and essential skills, based on when students enter high school. And usually that's their ninth grade year, but there are examples of students that may have skipped a ninth grade year in another state and came in. And so just so that you're all aware, that's what we mean. And that's why I've given you two different columns there. A cohort year, that's a reference to when they enter high school. And then we would have an anticipated graduation year of 08-09. Would be their 4-year rate, and then their 5-year rate would be if they needed any more time. If they needed just an extra summer to complete some requirements, they would then move into a 5th-year graduation rate. So you can see that in the 4-year graduation rate, it's been fairly stable. And this is all students. I'll disaggregate it a little bit more later, but this is all students, including those with disabilities. We produce the graduation and dropout rate in January of every year. So here in just another month and a half or 2 months, we'll have the 2009-10 cohort year information will be produced. So you can see the 4 and 5 year rates there. In Oregon, we have a federally approved 5-year rate quite a few states have both 4- and 5-year rates that are used for accountability purposes for schools and districts. There are even some states that have approved 6-year cohort graduation rates as well. And I put an asterisk next to the 2008-09 school or cohort year, rather, because that is the first year that the essential skill of reading was applied to those students. The students in our system that were identified as having entered high school in 2008 were required to demonstrate proficiency in the essential skill of reading in order to earn a regular or modified diploma. And then, of course, additional essential skills are added in the following 2 years. This is the same chart, but now I've whittled it down to students with disabilities. So you can see what the 4- and 5-year graduation rates look like for students with disabilities. Representative Gelser talked about how students with disabilities have the lowest graduation rate of all the subgroups. The delta or difference, if you will, between this slide and the previous slide typically is about 25%. So in almost every single one of those boxes, it drops about 25%. The one exception would be the 2008-09 4-year grad rate, which in the previous slide, was 68.4%, and then it drops 30%. Okay, so now looking very specifically at the 2007-2008 cohort, so remember that this is the last group of students that didn't have any essential skills applied to their graduation requirements. But I, again, just thought it might be useful to kind of contextualize what their rates look like in comparison to other subgroups that we often compare. So here you can see economically disadvantaged students, limited English proficient students, special education students, and then the combined disadvantage, which is a kind of a new category that has been used in the last year, year and a half, where we're pulling together the subgroups that are most often underserved. So it would include all of those, and it would also include some of the race ethnicity groups as well. I have a glossary at the end of this slide deck, and I'll make sure that it's available to everybody so that you can review definitions if you'd like. You can see how they compare, how each compares to the other. The total would again be the state level aggregate. One other point on this slide, again, Representative Gelser talked about it, 4-year cohort rate and 5-year cohort rate are references to regular diplomas. So in 4 years or more, up to 5 years, a student has received a regular Oregon diploma. That's what's counted in the numerator, if you will, of the calculation. The completer rate, which is the far right column, which is part of the achievement compacts, that includes basically every outcome with the exception of the alternative certificate. And you might remember from her document that there are no requirements really apply to the alternative certificate, and that's why it doesn't count in the 5-year completer rate. So there, I sort of think of the 4-year cohort grad rate and the 5-year completer rate as sort of opposite ends of the spectrum of different outcome calculations that we do.
And can, just as a clarification, in that 5-year completer rate with the 65.8, this is the cohort the year before the standards came into place.
Yes.
For the, so that, so my guess would be that the next year you'd probably see a decrease in the, because that would include alternative certificates, basically, right?
That, I don't believe they actually included it there, but that's possible. We haven't actually calculated the 5-year rate for 07-08 yet. That'll come out in January. So this, or pardon me, I'm sorry. No, we have the 5-year rate there. The next slide, we haven't done the 5-year rate. I'm going to show you the 08-09.
Right, but for the kids that started high school in 07-08,
yes,
they didn't yet have to meet those standards.
That's
for
true.
The
yeah.
modified and extended diploma.
Right.
So all of those could have
yes.
been anything from a district that required credits to someone that just gave us
yes.
a modified diploma because someone called and asked for one.
Absolutely right, yes. Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. And then this would be the next year, and the reason I wanted to show you 2007-08 as one cohort year as compared to 2008-09 is that this, again, is the first group that has the essential skill of reading applied, and this is the group that we don't have 5-year rates for. I forgot to amend the title there and remove the 5-year portion of it. So you can see how those groups compare to one another. In January, we will release 5-year rates for this particular group. Wanted to show you a little bit of information about the diploma counts, if you will, for students with disabilities. So again, you can kind of see what the regular diploma counts, modified diploma, and extended diploma counts look like. 2008-09, first year for the essential skill of reading. When we produce our report in January, it will include the next year as well. I do want to point out, I did a preliminary look. We haven't gone through a complete validation process yet for these diploma counts, but they look fairly consistent right now. Districts haven't had a chance to completely look through all of that data and validate it yet, so I wasn't quite confident enough to include it here. But things look very similar this year as they, as you see there in the 2008-09 cohort year row. So shifting gears just a little bit, 2008-09 cohort, these kids had the essential skill of reading. So I wanted to show you a little information about how districts submitted to us, told us that those kids met their essential skill of reading requirement. And again, comparing across the board there. For the special ed group of kids, 2,400 or so received a regular diploma, and you can see about 80% of them met via OAKS, and then another 18% used work samples. And I didn't put together any information to go into much detail about the different assessment options, if you will, but I would be happy to answer questions if anybody has questions about that particular area. And then shifting over to the modified diploma, you can see that those numbers are actually fairly consistent. A higher percentage of special ed students were able to use OAKS than the other options, but it's fairly negligible, I would say, that area. And then wanted to just show you a little bit about the dropout rates. The dropout rates are not calculated in a similar fashion as the cohort graduation rates or completer rates or any of the rates. Just to contextualize that a little bit, the graduation rates are based on what we call an adjusted cohort. And so what that means is as kids are going through their education experience, through their high school experience, we are accounting for when students move in and move out. So what they look like in their ninth grade year as a statewide group might look a little different than what they look like in their when they leave at the end of their 12th grade year. And so by adjusting that, we end up with a more refined, more accurate number. And we used to calculate it using something different than that. The dropout rates are a snapshot moment in time of the school. And the definition of a dropout is a student that didn't receive one of the many outcomes and didn't enroll in another institution that grants those outcomes. It's a kind of a rough definition, but that's essentially it. So they do not sync up and work together. And you can see what the trends have looked like. Again, in January, we'll produce the next year's rates around dropouts. As the person who used to, well, and still does, oversee the essential skills graduation requirements, one of the things that I heard anecdotally from districts a lot over the last few years is that we would see spikes in dropout rate. Spikes in modified diploma counts as well as potentially spikes in dropout rates also. And I think it remains to be seen if that's going to end up being true or not, but you can see what it's looked like for the last few years. And now I think I'm going to shift over to Sally to talk to these slides a little bit.
So when we look at this slide, one of the questions that Representative Gelser had asked about the top school districts that reported students that were leaving with a regular diploma, and then maybe a bottom number of districts. And so we looked at all. So if you look in that first column under all, you'll see that more than 90% of the students graduating with a regular diploma in 4 years, so districts reported 16% of those students were graduating with a regular diploma. Less than 60% of their students, so districts reported less than 60% of their students graduating with a regular diploma in 4 years, was at 17%. But Derek, if we go to the next slide, we removed districts having fewer than 10 students in their adjusted cohort because of the fact that there's some differences. If you're a district that has one leaver, you can either be at 0% or you can be at 100%. So if you have two leavers, you could be at you know, 50%, or you could be at 100%, or, you know, so there's different variables to this. But if you look at the difference when we removed those students from that category, 0% of the districts reported having those students, 90% of the special ed students leaving with a regular diploma. So that was the difference in this chart. And then it remained about the same for all. We have 94 school districts, but not all school districts have leavers. So that's why that number shows differently for 184, 172. You'll see a different number because not all schools had leavers in those years. So if we go to the next one, we talk a little bit about the post-school outcome data. This is actually a sampling of data that is required by school districts. So 1 year out after a student leaves the school, there is a phone call that's made. And in districts that have 15 or fewer, you call all of the people that leave. In districts that have 15 or more, you would call the amount that you have from each school or program within that district. So under indicator 14, there's three measurements. Measurement A is the students that are enrolled in higher ed at least one term. Measure B were youth enrolled in secondary school that or students that left school with an IEP, but they were enrolled in some other post-ed training program, competitive employment. And then, I skipped. Measure B is the youth that are enrolled in higher ed and competitive employment. And then Measure C is they're in other employment, like could be military, they're in secondary or competitive employment, so it's combined. And then
Does that include like alternatives to employment, the shelter work, shops?
No.
In that Measure C?
No, it doesn't include that in there. So part of the conversation that's not on there is the not engaged piece, which becomes really important for the State Department and school districts. That is not federally required for us to report, but that becomes really important when we make these phone calls to students, because there's a variety of questions that are asked, and there's also an area for them to be able to comment and say, this didn't work for me, or this did. So taking that data, school districts can look at using that data to make some decisions based on their programs to make them so that the outcomes for students become more successful.
So are there questions for Derek and Sally? None? Thank you. This was really helpful. And you gave the best in the committee earlier this year, just kind of the general graduation outcomes. You make things very easy to understand. So thank you for doing that. And to the department for putting the work into this. How hard would it be at the state level? I mean, could we engage that? And do we know who it is that's answering the phone? Is it skewing the disability type of student that's responding when those 50 calls go out? Is it equally balanced between those that are leaving with a standard diploma and those that left with a modified or a certificate of attendance? Can you reach kids in poverty and highly mobile kids as well as those that are more stable?
There is some data around that, to being able to figure that out. Some of the areas that we are training in this year is to help parents understand that and students that phone call is going to come to them. Because in this day and age, what we've heard reported from parents is that when a white envelope shows up in the mail that might remind them of that phone call, oftentimes that could go in the garbage as junk mail. Or if I call as a phone number that they don't recognize, they don't answer the phone. So we have spent some time. We've actually developed a little logo that looks like the Oregon license plate that says OR for PSO, and it has a little tree in the center of it. And we have given it to districts to use as a teaching tool for parents to understand that when they see this logo, it has to do with that phone call, and then have the student fill out the card in their own handwriting. So a year later, it's sent to them that we're going to make those phone calls. And I think with the new achievement compacts. People are going to have to figure out where kids went. There's going to be a measure on those achievement compacts. So what we've heard from school districts is they're no longer just going to call their 15, but they are going to probably be trying to make phone calls to everyone. It was much easier to make those phone calls when we all had hardwired phones. Mm-hmm. And so it's been more difficult to get a hold of people because numbers have changed in that type of activity. But there is an exit interview that's done before that student leaves school, and they get as much information as they can. Even grandma and grandpa, they give permission on whether that person could answer the questions for them. They give Facebook, now they're giving Facebook information, you know, all different types of information so that we have an opportunity to be able to contact that person.
What does that look like at your high school, the exit interview of students on IEPs?
It's the same issues, really. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that we're making big enough effort to chase down either. I mean, same thing with our cohort data. We found that there were a lot of kids with record. I mean that enrolled other places without a record request, and so you know we need to really clean that up if it's going to be reliable data.
Also, I brought out of the department every year is a transition manual that's used for training. And in there, it'll show you the PSO information. It'll tell you some of the definitions. It'll also show you some of the questions. And this year, we have divided it into four sections. So it's for administrators and the information that they would need, for teachers and case managers of new things that they might need this year. It's for agency partners, not for agency partners to use, but for us to share information about our agency partners. And then the last section is for parents and family, and again, it's to share information with parents and family, and I brought everyone a copy of this today.
You're welcome. I think Brian had a comment or a question.
I can piggyback on that. Do you know how that gets into the hands of administrators in the buildings?
Actually, I'm so excited this year. Last year when I started, I was told that I needed to hand out this book, and people from the field that knew me personally said, I never got one of those books. I've never even seen one of those books. So my goal last year in the statewide training at the department was to make sure everybody got one, and I told the directors who do SPR and I or whoever are involved in the SPR and I training. This year, I had leftover books, and I was still sending them out in June, which kind of made me sad because they weren't using the whole year to find information out. This year I gave out 1,200 books in less than a month. So we gave them out to VR counselors, we gave them out to personal agents, we gave them out to school districts, we gave them out to Employment First, we've given them out everywhere, and so that's our goal, is to get them into the hands of the people that are using them. I've heard more teachers tell me this year that they actually got them, and I think that's because I made a huge deal out of it when I was training the special ed directors around that area.
I think the reality, though, is you asked how the administrator gets it. The special ed director gets it, and we just manage it in our department. I mean, that's the mm-hmm. reality. I mean, it goes to your equity comment. I mean, it's really who owns the student with the disability, and it tends to be the special ed department. So when we're gathering the data, it's the case manager in the high school will sit down with the student and do the exit survey, and then typically someone out of the special ed office is spending weeks on end calling and calling and calling different people. That's kind of the reality of what ends up happening for us. We have the best data, so like when working with our district, that our teaching and learning department, they're jealous that we actually have any graduation data because they don't have that for a typical student. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to have that, but it's pretty time intensive and is typically housed just within the special ed department.
I've been working with National Post-School Outcome this year, the department has, to do some intensive TA, and we're looking at different options rather than making phone calls, whether it could be done electronically, whether people could sign in and do it so that it's not a phone call and it's not a burden. And the hard part about this collection, which is a great idea, but the collection starts when school's ending, and it stops when school starts again. So it comes out in June, and it's due by the end of September. So when people that don't understand school systems and the flurry of things when we're closing things down and the flurry of things when we're starting things back up again, but there's a really important report that's due during that time. So school districts have hired people, and what we've found is familiar people get more information than unfamiliar people. There's some sensitive questions that are being asked, and students are not readily available to those people to share that really sensitive information with people. So,
Sally, thank you very much. Is there anything else on this agenda item before we move on to the next one? Thank you very much. Thanks again, Derek. Next, we've got Jamie Dunphy from Senator Merkley's office to talk about some, go ahead and come on up to the table, some ideas we've been kicking around about federal financial aid for our students with modified diplomas.
Yeah, thanks for letting me come down and chat with everybody. So there's a very important component of what is going on the Oregon Modified Diplomas that can't be addressed directly by this, and that is the aspect of eligibility for federal student aid. Right now, the U.S. Department of Ed doesn't recognize modified diplomas as being valid, so these kids can't fill out their FAFSAs. And even if they can get into a university or a college of their own doing, they can't pay for it through the way that most students can. I am taking it upon myself as a project to try and fix that on a temporary level, because it sounds like what your committee is looking at largely doing is fixing that so that the language lines up with the federal component of it, so that it won't be an issue when you guys are done with this. But in the meantime, there are these kids who, I think I said roughly 8,000 students who have a modified diploma who can't go to college or can't pay for college the way that most of us did. I'm looking to get a federal waiver for the state of Oregon directly from the Secretary of Education to try and get these kids the ability to be eligible for federal student aid. I'm right now in the process of lining up key strategic partners who would be willing to draft letters of support, and my current plan of attack is to get a volume of people who have strategic say in and how this goes, both at agency level, at school district level. I want parent support. I'm trying to reach out to as many interested individuals, interested parties, to lend their support to me directly so that Senator Merkley's office can make this ask directly to the Secretary of Education with enough push to really make an impact. Part of my reason to come here is I wanted to, learn more about the intimate details of what you guys are trying to do, because it's very complex, and know if there is something more that I can be doing to help in the interim for the efforts that you guys are making. I don't know that there are, even in the best of circumstances, in reality. And additionally, to reach out to you guys, because everyone at this table is here for a reason, in that you have a vested interest in this. And so that means you are the wealth of information and contacts that I can utilize to help strengthen the case. So I want to make myself available. I've been working directly with Representative Gelzer on this, and I want to make myself, as an individual, I have business cards for anybody who might be either willing to help draft a letter of support or additionally know individuals in your Rolodex who would also be willing to. That's it. That's why I'm here.
And I think we probably need a waiver on an ongoing basis, because yes. I don't think the outcome of this work will be the elimination of modified diplomas, but the better understanding and not closing the door to...
Right, right. And that, so that's only a key, it's only one small part of it. And I think that depending on how... I have to see how things are going to fall into place. I don't know how things are going to fall into place once I actually get the formal ask in there. These things are always kind of unpredictable. So, yeah, absolutely. You're right. The result of your committee may not be statutory. It may not even be regulatory. It may not be that ever that what the Oregon has on the books as defined as a diploma ever really quietly lines up with what the feds are. But I think there's a wiggle room that we can make that difference and make that just go back, have them going back to not really quite looking, basically. If we just sort of like let the, if it's good enough for ODE, it should be good enough for DOE. And that's my take on it. You guys are clearly coming from a good place to be the better say on that than some administrative holdup on, you know, from somebody in D.C. I can't stand that kind of stuff, so I want to make sure that, you know, this project functions, and we're not just, you know, trying to adhere strictly to some definition set by somebody who's not in the state.
Bridget.
As long as you're going to go forward with an ask related to this, I think a second component that they took away that made this much more complicated was there used to be an ability to benefit test, whether right. that was work keys or asset, and work keys is a much more applied type of assessment than asset. And when they took that away, we lost the access for those students who may have a modified diploma but could demonstrate that they actually are college ready and have the ability to benefit from right. college. And so I would actually like to see both of those. I mean, for sure I'd like to see modified count, but I would also like to see the ability to benefit come in, because I think there are students who their diploma doesn't necessarily represent who they are and what they know and how they can benefit. And so if we could right. try and get both in, it would help.
I know that will be a much bigger lift, because the ability benefit is that would be a nationwide thing. That would have to come through the form of legislation.
Can we get a waiver to use ability to benefit as well?
Maybe.
I met with Senator Harkin last year about this issue, and I asked for a waiver and ability to benefit. And the concern about ability to benefit was that the system was being misused by some private for-profit career schools, where the student would go in, they would write their own ability to benefit test and tell the student they had the ability to benefit. The student would then bring in the Pell Grant and the student loans, and they wouldn't make it through the first year, so they would leave. The college would have the Pell Grant and the tuition payment, and the student left with a bunch of student debt. So the concern was, how do you put that in a way that that isn't open for that type of abuse. So Harkin's office was very negative about going back in that direction, and he chairs the HELP committee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. They were a little bit more open to the idea of a waiver, except for that the idea that we had a modified diploma that had statewide debt standards was really foreign to that office, because in most states it is this very informal kind of a thing. So I went and talked with the U.S. Department of Education as well, Office of Special Education Programs, and they also were kind of hung up on that piece. Well, what do you mean they're statewide standards? What are they? Are they rigorous? Can people just put them down? So I think if people are writing letters of support to send in, it would be important to emphasize those standards, and that the waiver would be limited to a state-recognized diploma or a state-recognized diploma with standards.
I think the ability to benefit, it would be a much bigger I'm not saying it's not a goal for the long term. If I have one place to put my energy though for now, but absolutely you're right, that is something that has been brought up, and I have it in mind as things proceed. I'm not a legislative aide though. I'm actually a constituent services representative. I do casework for the senator. So this actually fell in my lap from a constituent whose dyslexic daughter is about to graduate from high school and found out she can't pay for PCC. So like, that's where this first came into my attention. And so that's the angle I want to just get. I'm wanting to get that kid back in school. So, but it's absolutely a component of this as we go forward. Yeah.
So, Jamie, we have a network of people who they'll have parents who could write letters, and then special ed directors throughout the state who could do it. What would be helpful, though, is to have some language that we should look to include in there.
Absolutely.
So that our message comes home. So it's kind of that same message, but, you know, there's a different story or background to it. So if you could
absolutely
get us something like that, that would be helpful, because then we can go ahead and get you the letters. That's easy.
Yeah, right now I'm mostly trying to line up names and then get the letters. Like I want to get, you know, I've gotten informal support from a dozen or more either elected officials or agencies across the state who are willing to get in that line. I want to get just lined up and then move into the next stage. So that this is my first. I mean, in my opinion, this is the beginning of where I am. This is a long journey. I'd like to get it accomplished by the time the current seniors graduate. I don't know if that's realistic, but that's my goal. And so, in the early part of next year, I'm going to start moving into more of the substantive stages. And once I have contacts and can get things out to networks, that's absolutely my next step.
Any other questions for Jamie? Jamie, thanks for taking the initiative on this and jumping into it with so much energy. And
absolutely. So you guys know, my prior life before working for Senator Merkley, I was a behavioral specialist at a middle school. So all of my students had IEPs. And these were it was primarily a lot of gang prevention stuff. But I helped a lot of kids turn their lives around. And to find out now that some of these kids who are, you know, bright and talented but had some problems are not going to get to go to college after all the work I put into that, that's not happening. So I thank you guys for helping me, and thanks for letting me come down and meet with you. And I look forward to working with you guys in the future.
And do you have a card?
I do.
Do you have people?
Yeah. I have a bunch of cards. I never get to use my cards. They don't let me at the office very often.
Make sure they get in the box.
That's easy.
I'll leave a few here if anybody else wants them. So.
Thanks Jamie. A lot.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
So that completes the formal agenda for today, except for talking about our work plan and next steps. Are there other things for the good of the order that people want to add before we move to that piece? So given school schedules and where we are in November, I would anticipate that meeting in December might be challenging. Not necessarily. So I'll have Victoria work with everyone to see if we can get a December meeting with critical mass. And if not, early January. We'll need to meet probably at least twice more before February to be ready for that February meeting. For the next meeting, in terms of thinking about how to meet the goals that are there, I was thinking that at the next meeting we could have some reports and people bring in information about transcripting, how student work is transcripted, always having financial aid conversations at these meetings, some conversations about the documentation of student support needs going in to college, and what outreach is happening to students kind of all the way through in terms of those connections onto college. And I hope that all of you could communicate with me so we can find the right people to bring that information to us as part of the study. And that we would just continue moving through that list of things we're supposed to study until we've studied it all, or some of it. Is that acceptable to people? Is there anything else that people think should be in our next meeting that wasn't just listed?
I would add the NPSO, National Post-Secondary Outcome, the data and that stuff, I'm fascinated by. I love it. I don't get to see it, unfortunately, because of where my statue is or whatever, so it's hard for me to access in my place. But the purpose and the mission behind that to ultimately know where kids go after they graduate and come back and affect change in what you call your transition programs, that's classroom change right there. And when you started with what your directive is and things like that, and from my experience, you mentioned like districts can have different transition programs, and then a district could have a few buildings, high school buildings, with such a wide range of what they consider transition services, whether it's me one-on-one or me in a classroom or a YTP or a VR person or a job coach coming in. And all these things are so, in essence, complicated. But if you're really looking at making some kind of movement towards changing the actual instruction happening there, the NPSO data is so important. And then getting that into, if it's district hands to just slowly trickle down is just huge. And we blew through those two slides, and there's so much in there, understanding what a lever is and where they go and what that means and the different definitions. And if building principals do or don't, or administrators do or don't know this, it's fascinating because, like, a leaver, I go off to college and I take one class, and now I end up in group A maybe, and everybody's like, sweet, that's awesome. But that one class, I failed. I never went back in the spring. I mean, there are a lot of intricates, but you can really tease and play with that data to really drive change. And it's there, but it's also changed over years, because when MPSO first started, they defined leavers in one measure, and then somewhere in there, and I'm not clear, they redefined what a leaver meant. So what does it mean if you have a job for so many weeks or so many months, that's 30 hours or more a week or 20 hours or more a week? That changed your definition, and it changed the way those phone calls, what data we were trying to collect back and report, and that's huge. It goes into the workplace and what you would be reporting back and all over the place. So if we're really looking at getting something out of that, I think getting into the MPSO would be remarkable.
So what if we added on some more in-depth around the MPSO and invited from the OEIB someone from the subgroup that's looking at that tracking and how they are...
OEIB is...
So the Oregon Education Investment Board is kind of looking at that pre-kindergarten through 20... participation of students and how they're going, what's happening to students over time. And one of the goals of the OEIB is to better track college success of students who have left Oregon High School and then enrolled in colleges. So exactly the point you talked about. Did they just go to one class and fail, or did they actually graduate and leave with something? But it might be a good idea to get this on their radar as well, so that as they're looking at that information, the students we're talking about here are also incorporated in that state level data as well. And MPSO might be a good thing for them to know about too.
Representative Gelser, I have to kind of, you know, thinking about this, if we're looking at making, you know, if we end up deciding to make recommendations for what a transition program looks like, it's going to be really important to look at the different smaller communities. But there's another piece that's there where when we look at funding pieces, so if we move for legislation to say transition programs will look this way, the reality is the special ed director is going to have to figure out how to comply with that with the same funding they have, knowing we have a reduction through IDEA and sequestration. And so I just, you know, it's not that I don't always want to say, yay, let's do that. It is a caution just that there are key players from the general ed side. You know, Matt's here, but Matt, you know, is not the typical principal. And so it's just a reality that we're going to have to figure out how to bring those partners in, because districts tend not want to increase their maintenance of effort for special education. And that's really, you know, so what are you going to sacrifice instead? So it's just, I have to put that on the table, because we'll shoulder it in our office, but it's going to have implications.
Bridget.
I think at some point it would be important to have somebody who's knowledgeable about the college now, the expanded options, because a lot of times in districts those are seen as, well, you already have special education, so this is for alternative ed schools or other students. And that will be, as you mentioned, a critical thing until we get the financial aid fixed out. It becomes even more important that they get access to post-secondary education before they leave the K-12 system. And so I think trying to stay up on those, I know just for myself as a pre-service person, so I can make sure we know, is really hard. So it would be nice, I think, to look at those. I mean, I think even, Mike, some of the money, the funding that's coming out of executive order and stuff, and how does that play into, you know, where all these agendas that seem to be heading towards the same direction, how can we use them better? And
anybody else? Well, thank you all for making time to come today to get this kicked off, and Victoria will be in touch to get us set up for our next meeting, and we're adjourned. Thank you.